Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. yesterday I talked a bit about the spirit of a monastic retreat, and I'd like to continue to put a plug in. just in the sense of, because sometimes I think people can maybe assume that like a monastery is just a kind of a, like a meditation center on steroids or something, you know, where they just go and practice meditation and just ramp it up. It's a whole sort of training and way of life and lifestyle, and a monastery is. Say it's not just for monastics. I mean, it's the monasteries are open places for the lay community to plug into, and that was one of the things that really inspired me to draw close to Ajahn Chah as a teacher, as a spiritual guide, because I'd ordained to meditate a bit longer. So I'm speaking from experience here. that was what I didn't really know much about Buddhism. I just wanted to know more about meditation. And I took a temporary ordination. I figured 3, maybe 4 months max. By that time you'd at least be a stream enter. at least I wouldn't have to fall into the hell realm. So, okay. I knew that much. but then I kept hearing about these forest monasteries and hearing about Ajahn Chah up in the northeast of Thailand. So my preceptor where I ordained encouraged me to go and pay respects. So I went. And that was one of the things that really struck me, is that what Ajahn Chah was doing was making the practice of Buddhism something that you incorporated into all aspects of your life. I mean, you meditate also, train with mindfulness also, but it's a whole way of incorporating all aspects of one's life into the practice. And it was also something that included and encouraged the lay community to be engaged in. And that was really inspiring. And it was, you know, it was also kind of intimidating, because you're sitting up at the front and you're in these robes and mean, I can hardly sit still, and these lay people who come, the observance, lunar observance nights every week, there'd be, 100, 200 lay people there to spend the whole night practicing meditation. And it didn't look like they moved. How did you do that? So that, there's this recognition of, this is incorporating the practice into all sort of different aspects, so that we have these 10 days, and to pick up the practice with that perspective or that consideration. Now, how do I bring this into not just the sitting meditation in the meditation hall and the periods of walking meditation? How do I incorporate it into the transitions? How do I incorporate it into the chores that I'm doing, or the meal time? Different times when it's not sort of quote unquote meditation time, and that's where this continuity of practice or steady practice. If we have a steadiness in practice, not because we're in full lotus with our hands in some sort of mudra, but our establishing of mindfulness and investigation is there, so that using the chores that we're doing, one to be mindful, and being mindful is also not just being mindful of the task you're doing, but also the context of what you're, how you're doing it, who are you working with, what kind of proximity are you in with others, how do you maintain a mindfulness and a supportive atmosphere, so that other people have the opportunity to practice mindfulness as well. Because sometimes we can be so mindful of what we're doing and just irritate the people around us. it's not really helpful. It can be, because the purpose of the Buddhist teachings is to be able to relinquish self. Because sometimes, that practice of mindfulness and my practice becomes very self-centered, becomes very self-absorbed. And it's not for, say, the overcoming of suffering for oneself or for the alleviating of suffering for others. As a perspective, how do I be mindful and discerning in the activity that I'm doing, and getting a balance. Like if you're doing kitchen cleanup and mindfully scouring at one spot on the pot, and it's clean, but there's other pots to do too. how do I perform a task skillfully and beneficially, and use it to be mindful. Also, the attitude that we bring to it, because we, especially with engaging in activity. And so it's like in the, before the meal, I made the comment of recollecting, yeah, the, what we're doing is, you know, we're eating, we're consuming the fruits of the generosity of others. But then we can also bring our attention to, we can bring generosity, that spirit of generosity to what we're doing. So in the particular yogi jobs that, that one's doing, also just you go into the washroom, it's a public washroom, you know, if things aren't neat and tidy, haven't been cleaned up, it's sort of, it isn't as if it's somebody else's problem. It's, no, we can leave things clean and neat and tidy. You know, use that as a an opportunity to keep paying attention to that detail. And it can, oh, it needs to be cleaned. Somebody forgot. Okay, there's any number of reasons why somebody will forget to do something, but it isn't sort of, you know, come out of there grumbling and complaining and say, well, the toilet's not clean. I said, oh, I can do that. I can give myself to that. And that, actually, the in the Thai forest monasteries, there's kind of a saying that if you want to know the quality of practice in a monastery, go and take a look at the toilets. No, just, you know, it doesn't really show up when they're, say, sitting in front of the Buddha with the robes neatly on. That may not be a good indication. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, go take a look at the toilets. You get a better sense of how people's practice is manifesting. Also, Ajahn Chah used to say that, yeah, if I want to understand how, say, what's going on in somebody's mind or what shape somebody's mind is in, I just go around and peek into their dwelling places, see what you know. Is it just like some kind of hurricane has come through and it's just it's chaos, or is it, you know, is it neat and tidy, looked after? Is it, because that's you know, the encouragement for us in our training was always to, you go back from after the meal time, you put out your robes on the line, you air them, you sweep up around your dwelling place, you sweep up in the dwelling place, get everything neat and tidy, then you do your walking meditation. That's just the routine you get in. Living with Ajahn Chah, that was the encouragement that you got. So it's a part of the overall training of the mind. It's not just a meditation technique. It's an overall training of our being. So that opportunity of paying attention to the place that we're, say, the retreat center that we're in, the public areas that we all use, our own rooms and residences, just really looking after them. That's a part of this 10-day retreat, and you'll find that it will it brightens the mind. Another aspect of being a monastic retreat is just the having some devotional aspects, having a shrine, and I delight in the fact that quite a few people, many people, brought flowers, so that we have. You look at the shrine, and there's flowers on it, and it's nice and neat. There's an image of the Buddha. To me, it's uplifting. It's an uplifting image. If you're sitting in meditation, your eyes closed, and kind of mind's all over the place, sometimes you sit and take a look at the shrine. There is the presence of the Buddha in the world. I mean, both the, say, historical or the an image that is trying to mirror back, as well as the principle of the Buddha principle of awakening, of one who is free. I remember a layman telling me one time that he was from Ubon, the town that where province where Ajahn Chah lived, and he was a supporter of Ajahn Chah from quite a young age, But, Ubon's a bit of a backwater, so he went off to Bangkok, big city, to further his, establish a business. And he actually did very well. He was in the gem trade. But nature of, business, sometimes it's stressful and sometimes it's confusing, and so he said, "Bob, it'd be really difficult for me to keep my meditation consistent, but every day, without fail, I would go into my shrine room and I would sit there. And even if my mind's all over the place, and I just sit and tell my troubles to the Buddha and my picture of Ajahn Chah." so like a devotional recollection. I think for most of us as Westerners, devotional practices are not so familiar, not so high up in the list of what we see as valuable in the Buddha's teachings. But in terms of a kind of like a whole package of how we support our ongoing practice and our ongoing aspiration for freedom from dukkha, these aspects of devotional practice, a shrine, chanting, these are opportunities for, not just bringing forth devotion, but also reconnecting or remembering what is the principle of the Buddha, that awakening, being an awakened being. How do I awaken myself? Dhamma pointing to truth. How do I keep connecting with truth? How do I connect with Sangha as not just as external being somewhere, but how do I become one who practices in a good way, practices directly, practices insightfully? These are things that we can use these external symbols to remind us of the principles. Also, just with chanting, it actually sounds like we've got a group of good chanters here. There's sometimes have a people who are enthusiastic. But tone deaf? That's a real killer. because a lot of chanting is actually learning how to listen. And that's, a lot of living as a human being is learning how to listen. we're learning something with everything that we're engaging in, that we're doing, and this is a kind of an ethos or basis of a monastic retreat, obviously I've been giving meditation instruction. But also, there is this broader, this bigger picture that is important to recollect. And like Ajahn Chah, it was always interesting. He would, he was a great, he was an accomplished meditator himself. He was a great meditation teacher, but spending time with him and hearing him giving teachings and going back and either listening or reading the collected teachings that we put together, he put a lot more emphasis on two particular things. Sila, in terms of virtue or skillful conduct, and samadhiti, right view. Those two qualities are the things that hold the practice, and they hold our living a human life, and they hold our meditation. So that sense of when our meditation is held in the sphere of virtue and right view, then the meditation naturally grows, naturally deepens. It has a solid base and foundation to really allow the mind to settle. So that contemplating just this aspect of sila, of virtue. And sila is sort of in the Buddha's Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Those are aspects of sila. That's a very dry definition. There's a stock phrase that comes up over and over again in the suttas of when the Buddha describes virtue, and he points to it, or encouraging us to maintain our virtue with integrity, and keeping it unstained, but it's also kind of pointing to what the say the principles that allow sila to really bring the most fruit, so that keeping the sila or one's virtuous conduct in a way that's, say, unstained, unblotched. But then its characteristic is also, I said, it's freeing. Because sometimes, moral conduct can be a source of neurotic obsession. But that's not what the Buddha is pointing. He's pointing to conduct that is freeing. It allows the mind to really settle, put down a whole lot of doubts or worries or fears or anxieties. And so that's actually it's also one of some places where one of the benefits of sila is that one can comfortably enter into any assembly, any gathering of people without any feeling of disease. But so this sense of this unstained, freeing, praise by the wise, and leading to concentration. I don't think I remember all of them. There's several different, but the last quality is just leading to concentration. So that when we are attentive to our conduct, our virtue, then it has that effect. The mind settles easily. It's supportive of a stillness of mind. So that being attentive to our sila is also one of the meditation objects that the Buddha points to as a recollection, sila anusati, because there's a group of meditations that are discursive meditations. They're called anusatis, so they're recollections. So that, of course, recollection of the Buddha, recollection of the Dhamma, recollection of Sangha. These are meditation objects that we can lift up, and they're more discursive, but they settle the mind. There's also sila anusati, recollection of virtue. And when we recollect, say, conduct that was skillful and wholesome, we can delight in that. And the mind settles when there's a continuity of delight. And it's not sort of delight in the sense of, oh, I'm better than others, but it's more delight, oh, well, yeah, that was well done, that was skillful. There's also a discourse where the Buddha kind of goes through for one who is virtuous, there's no need for an act of will for freedom from remorse to arise. It is natural that freedom from remorse will arise in one who is virtuous. And then there's a teaching that the Buddha gives in many places, and he picks it up from there, and it's like and there's no need for an act of will in one who has freedom from remorse for delight to arise. And pramoja is a kind of delight in the mind, a well-being. And so for one, and there's no need for one with delight, who experiencing delight, there's no need for an act of will for joy to arise. It's natural that joy will arise in one who is delighted. And the same with it. It's natural for one who is joyful to experience pleasure, sukha. And it's and there's no need for an act of will. One who's experiencing pleasure, for samadhi to arise, it's natural that one who experiences pleasure, that they will for them. Especially when it's grounded in these very wholesome roots. As there's in that sequence of say conditioned phenomena within the mind, there's other places where the Buddha actually stops and says he's encouraging to cultivate delight, cultivate joy, cultivate pasati, with tranquility and ease of body. Relaxation of the body, cultivate pleasure, and there's sometimes they'll stop. Pleasure, happiness. The happy mind is easily concentrated. I think it's really important to recollect that, remember that, reflect. How do I allow the mind to be happy, allow the heart to be happy? Not basing it on my desires, my preferences, my ideals, my views and opinions, but on truth. Because usually we practice, our practice is kind of opposite to that. In the sense of, when I get my samadhi, then I'm going to be happy. I get my meditation together, and I'm going to be happy. But I'm paying attention to the roots of happiness. And then the Buddha goes on. It's not necessary to apply an act of will for one who is, say, concentrated, has a steady, peaceful mind, has experiencing samadhi, to see things in their true nature. It is natural that the peaceful mind sees things in their true nature. And in the same way that seeing things in their true nature brings into being a disenchantment, a dispassion, a relinquishment. This is a natural progression, particularly when we get out of the way. Put our attention, put our effort toward things that are skillful or wholesome, and of course that that sila is a major foundation for that. And then say as Ajahn Chah would put that virtue, right, and right view. Those work together, and right view is, in the Buddha's words, he points to two aspects of right view. One is on a mundane, conventional level, in in the sense of understanding and accepting the nature of karma, of action and result. There are the fruits of actions. There is good. There is bad. There is the fruits of generosity. There is the fruits of our skillful action. There's the fruits of our unskillful action. It's a natural law. So that understanding that we're not just passive recipients of a random universe. We're engaged in it. We can put forth effort to create the source of our well-being. We also have to be attentive to refrain and pull back from the things that are unskillful and bring about unskillful results. So we can learn that, we can understand that. So that's right view on the with the basis of personality, identity, a being. But then the Buddha points to also a right view on a transcendent level, and that's where it's a Four Noble Truths. There is dukkha, there is the cause of dukkha, there's the cessation of dukkha, there's the path leading to cessation of dukkha. And because that's shifting and looking at things through, not through the eyes of a being or a person or an identity or an entity, but looking at it phenomenologically. You see, these are phenomena that appear, that arise and cease. And we can step out of the realm of personality, and that is liberating. That self-identity, we can go beyond that, and it is liberating. So, but both of those work together. They're not there's not some huge wall between them. They're feeding each other, they're informing each other, and that as we practice and train and investigate, incorporating that into all the different aspects of our life, of our activity, of our meditation. So that sense of practice becoming something that is, there's a continuity of practice, there's a steadiness of practice that takes place, and another way of looking at it is also just seeing things in their true nature, and that's where the Buddha points to those aspects of anicca, dukkha, anatta, of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. And we can, we're surrounded by it all the time. You know, we can be directing our attention to that. We can be alert to these universal characteristics. The Buddha is very explicit in saying, whether a Buddha is born into the world or is not born into the world, all phenomena are impermanent, unsatisfactory. There is non-self. That is, the Buddha is the one who points that out and gives us the tools to free ourselves from that. But that is the nature of things. And we can be investigating that, recollecting that, incorporating that into our practice, into our recollection as we are engaging with whatever we're doing. And that's traditionally in Theravada tradition, that's the basis of insight. Liberating insight arises out of seeing those universal characteristics. And that's something we can be constantly reminding ourselves, constantly recollecting. And it has the effect of cooling, of settling, of brightening the mind. And we have to actually incorporate that into, say, our experience. It isn't just sort of, okay, reading about it one day and then remembering it, or slapping the label on the different things around us. Oh, nicca dukkha anatta, nicca dukkha anatta. It's really bringing it in and feeling it, experiencing it, seeing it. That's actually how it is. That's where Ajahn Chah, I remember him saying that, he said, like reading about it in the text and just remembering it he said it's like having a bottle of water. And it's kind of refreshing. You get able to drink from your bottle of water, but pretty soon your bottle runs out. He said it's not, but. Learning how to apply it and see it and really experience it is like having your own spring. With water is constantly there for the taking. So that that truth is all around us. But to be able to internalize it. And of course that's when we do the chanting. It's one of the qualities of the Dhamma that we chant. Open Aiko, it's leading inwards. We have to draw the teachings into the heart and experience them there. Make them clear for ourselves. Lead it inwards and draw it into the heart so that it's felt, it's experienced, it's understood, it's realized. And it's something that we do. So I'll offer that for reflection this afternoon.
Sadhu, sadhu.